This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's official. The coming heat waves will be longer, hotter, and stickier. Under any scenario for the coming climate, Americans are going to face heat like they have never seen before. Christina Dahl is a senior climate scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She is lead author of a new paper titled Increased Frequency of and Population Exposure to Extreme Heat Index Days in the United States During the 21st Century. Christina Dahl, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
What does it take for the U.S. National Weather Service to issue a public heat warning?
Whether or not the National Weather Service issues a public heat advisory or warning depends on where you are in the country. So as a national guideline, the National Weather Service suggests issuing a heat advisory when the heat index is expected to exceed 100 degrees Fahrenheit for a couple of days. And they recommend issuing an excessive heat warning when the heat index is expected to be over 105. But different local National Weather Service offices have their own guidelines, and that's because people in different parts of the country have different levels of acclimation to extreme heat. So if you live in parts of New England, for example, say New Hampshire, they tend to issue a heat advisory at a lower heat index, more like 90 or 95, because the people there are less accustomed to extreme heat. On the flip side, if you live in Texas, where days with a heat index above 100 are fairly common, the threshold for issuing a heat advisory tends to be a bit higher.
Yeah, it's the same internationally. I've noticed that the heat warnings come out in the UK much sooner at a much lower temperature than they would, for example, in Spain or certainly than in the Middle East, where that's just another day. So we know global warming is already happening. Why did you and your team go to so much work to figure out just how hot it could be?
We know that extreme heat is very dangerous to our health. When the heat index spikes, we see increases in emergency room admissions. We see increases in the rates of heat stroke, which can be fatal. And so we know with global warming that this type of extreme heat will likely get worse. We wanted people to be able to see what was coming and to have a chance to take action to steer our future in a different direction.
Is there much difference between the thing that all the policy documents talk about? They talk about the global mean temperature increase and what actually happens, say, in each American city?
There is. So we see that with global warming, we'd expect the average temperature over the entire year to increase. But that also often comes along with an increase in extreme conditions. So having that average temperature rise just a little bit can push it so that those extreme temperature and humidity conditions become more likely or more common. People tend to acclimate to whatever the average temperature is in their region, but it's much harder when we are faced with a day with a heat index, say, of 105. That's when our health really starts to suffer.
So I think that's about 40 degrees C for our European listeners is around 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Is that right?
That's about right, yes.
So for this study, you used two different possible futures. What did you count as a low emission scenario coming up, and then what did you count as high emissions?
We know that extreme heat is very sensitive to our greenhouse gas emissions, which are our heat-trapping emissions that come primarily from the burning of fossil fuels like oil, coal, and gas. And so we wanted to look at a range of different futures to see what the benefits would be of cutting our emissions quickly and dramatically. So we looked at a low emission scenario in which in the very near term, we start to swiftly and dramatically reduce our carbon emissions. And in that scenario, we're able to limit future global warming to about 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. We also looked at a high emission scenario in which our carbon emissions continue to rise through the end of the century. And in that case, we see a global average warming of about 4 degrees Celsius or about 8 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. And then we looked at a middle-of-the-road scenario where our carbon emissions start to rise through the middle of the century and then decrease after about the year 2050.
Well, supposing I'm listening in Houston, it's already hot and muggy a fair amount of the year. Is it really going to be all that different in 2050 or later?
That's a question we often get asked. People will say, well, I already live in a hot place and I can use the air conditioning more. I have an air-conditioned home and office and I should be fine. But the type of heat that we project that places like Texas will feel is truly unprecedented for that region. So we looked at a phenomenon that we call off-the-charts days. So these are days when the combination of temperature and humidity is so hot that we can't reliably calculate a heat index. Historically, in the United States, those conditions have only happened for a couple of days per year and only in the Sonoran Desert. That's the desert region of Southern California and Arizona. What we saw was that even by mid-century, those off-the-charts heat conditions would start to spread across much of the country. And by the end of the century, about 60% of the United States would experience those off-the-charts conditions at least once per year. Those conditions would be highly concentrated in places like Texas, where it's already hot, and you don't need a whole lot more warming to push yourselves into those off-the-charts territories.
Yeah, I was shocked to see in your report that a few areas like eastern Texas, Louisiana, and South Florida are projected to experience 50 to 100 days per year where the humidity index will feel like it's 105 degrees Fahrenheit, over 40 degrees C. That could be 3 months of stinking hot. Is that a lot more than the present generation is used to?
It is. So we see that by mid-century, both the frequency of the extreme heat and the intensity would increase. So people may be used to, say, 20 days per year with a heat index of 100. But by mid-century, we'd be looking at about 50 days with a heat index above 100. So those really miserably hot days that even people in Texas and Florida complain about as being very hot would become much more frequent. But we'd also see a rise in the number of days that are even hotter than that. So it's both the frequency of those unpleasant days and the intensity of them that would really create these unprecedentedly hot conditions.
Are coastal places like San Francisco or New York protected from the coming super heat waves?
Coastal places tend to be a bit cooler than their inland counterparts. San Francisco is naturally a very cool city. The temperature of the ocean water just offshore is very cold, and so it tends to keep temperatures very mild. So that remains the case in the future. We don't see places like San Francisco becoming as hot as Arizona. But just inland from the immediate coast, we do see quite a bit of warming, such that places like the Central Valley of California, where much of the produce is grown for the entire country, become extremely hot.
We're already seeing fires there. It seems like unseasonably early fires. I guess that could be relative to that heat and humidity, too.
That's right. When it's very hot in California and across the western U.S., we tend to see a tendency toward more wildfires and fires that burn greater areas and move faster. So what we looked at in our study was heat index, which is a combination of temperature and humidity. Typically, if we have high humidity, that tends to reduce the risk of fire. When it's very arid or very dry, is when we tend to see higher fire risk in the western U.S.
Christina, are there places in America which could remain relatively safe or really not that much changed in a increase of killer heat where our survivalists can run away to?
Well, we do see places that would remain refuges from extreme heat. And those places tend to be high elevation areas like the Rocky Mountains or the Sierra Nevada. But it's really important to note that even those places get warmer in our projections. And it's also important to note that our study really just looked at the extreme heat piece. So it doesn't take into account the fact that those areas that may be refuges from extreme heat may be seeing increased wildfire risk in the future. Climate change will bring with it a host of different impacts, and extreme heat is just one of them. So I'd be hesitant to say that there's any place in the U.S. where you could completely avoid the effects of climate change in the future.
I noticed reading the study that the doubling and tripling of hot days and super hot days found in your study, it's relative to a pretty recent dateline. You're not talking about a big increase from the year 1900 or pre-industrial, but from 1971 to 2000 as a baseline, that's well within the life experience of some of our listeners. Did that surprise you?
It did and it didn't. So we did look at a baseline that averaged conditions from 1971 to 2000. But we know that in recent years, just the last 5 years, have been the hottest 5 years on record for the U.S. So people are already starting to feel the effects of the fact that we have warmed significantly since the 1970s. So given that we were comparing that historical period to a mid-century time period starting in the year 2036, that's about 50 years from the beginning of that historical period we looked at to the beginning of the mid-century time period. And we know we've seen a lot of warming already in that period. And we are projecting with those scenarios that our greenhouse gas emissions would rise between now and mid-century. So we did expect to see at least some increase in the frequency of extreme heat between that historical period and the middle of the century. But I think all of my co-authors and I were surprised at just how quickly that rise in extreme heat happens.
Right. We don't have to wait to the year 2100 to see this. It's already happening to some extent, but some of the results in your paper show up 2040, 2050.
That's right. Well, within the lifetimes of many of us, and certainly within the lifetimes of our children, that we could be seeing a doubling or tripling in the frequency of days with a very high heat index.
In our Radio EcoShock show for June 5th, 2019, I interviewed Princeton atmospheric scientist Jane Baldwin. She led a study finding not only is it going to get hotter, but a trend of back-to-back heat waves is already showing up, and that'll put more stress on people and on infrastructure in America. Did you notice that phenomenon of heat waves with little relief in between them in your models?
That's a really important question, because when we look at the health impacts of a heat wave, we can see that if temperatures don't cool off at night and people aren't given that opportunity for their bodies to cool off, the health impacts tend to compound. So when you have multiple days that are hot and you're not getting relief at night from those days, the health effects can be very detrimental. In our study, we primarily looked at individual days of extreme heat, but we did do a little bit of digging into how the length of heat waves would change. And even between now and mid-century, we found that the average length of a heat wave would increase. We'd be looking at more frequent extreme heat, more intense extreme heat, and longer-lasting extreme heat.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Christina Dahl from the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking about the coming new extreme heat in the United States as the world warms. You know, Christina, time after time during extreme weather, TV reporters find some old person saying, "Well, I've never seen anything like this before." Please tell us, what is a no-analog situation in your study?
So what we call no-analog or off-the-charts conditions are conditions where the temperature and the humidity combined are so hot that they fall above the upper limit of our ability to calculate the heat index. So the heat index is often called the feels-like temperature. It's what our bodies essentially are feeling when it's very hot and humid. So these no analog or off the charts conditions have historically only occurred in the U.S. in the Sonoran Desert region. And that's why we call them no analog, because or off the charts, because most of the country has never experienced these kinds of conditions before.
And you also studied population exposure, and you had three different scenarios of population growth in the coming America. Why do that? Why work on the days of population exposure?
Even as our climate changes, our population will change as well. So an international group of researchers has created a suite of different population change scenarios, and they're predicated on all sorts of different things, like, you know, whether populism is on the rise and whether we continue using fossil fuels. So there's a huge range of different population projections, not just for the U.S., but for the whole world. So we wanted to know, if we have this increased frequency of extreme heat, how many more people are going to be exposed to it? And in order to really answer that question for the future, you need to think about how population is going to change too. So we looked at a range of different population scenarios, from one where the U.S. population actually contracts slightly to one where it really explodes and becomes much larger. But overall, what we found was that the number of people exposed tends to be more dependent on our greenhouse gas emissions trajectory than our population trajectory. In other words, the choices that we make about our carbon emissions in the coming decades will be more important than any population factors that lead to an increase or decrease in our population.
It's going to be pretty tricky, because there could be waves of climate migration within the United States as people, say, move away from the coasts due to rising seas or look for places that are cooler. I have a correspondent who moved from Washington, D.C. up to Minnesota because she just couldn't take the hot, stinking days in D.C. anymore. So I think there's going to be millions of people on the move as they try and find a better place during climate change.
Yeah, it will remain to be seen how people in the U.S. or anywhere else respond to an increase in the frequency of extreme heat. We really don't know yet what people in the U.S. will be able and willing to endure. But we do know that many Americans dislike extremely hot days. They limit our activities. They're costly if you're running your air conditioning at home. They threaten our health, and just quite simply, it makes many of us uncomfortable, if not miserable. So the population change scenarios that we looked at don't account for any of those climate-driven migrations that might occur within the U.S. or around the world. They're much more holistic and broader looking than that. But we certainly could see people making the choice to leave hotter regions of the country and seek these more cool refuges in the future.
Now, on July 29th, 2019, you provided written testimony to the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, a hearing on the need for resilience, preparing America's transportation infrastructure for climate change. Christina, what did you tell them about the need to prepare for a hotter future?
We know that extreme heat can affect many types of infrastructure. You can see asphalt deteriorating or even starting to deform when it's extremely hot. We know that trains often need to be slowed down or stopped entirely when it's extremely hot because the rails can buckle. And when it's very, very hot, we even have trouble having planes take off. So there are many ways that extreme heat could affect transportation in the future. And so as we begin to make decisions about our infrastructure and how we're building and what we're building, we really need to be looking ahead into the future. We want our infrastructure to be built to last. And in order to last us 50 years, we need to be thinking about the frequency of extreme heat 50 years from now.
And I'm thinking, too, of farmers. They've got a schedule based on weather and seasons that they grew up with, or at least recently experienced weather. But according to your report from the Union of Concerned Scientists, that experience might become outdated, possibly within two decades, And I wonder if a change in the heat index could threaten our food exports or even eventually our food supply.
Farmers are already starting to feel the effects of climate change. I was at a conference recently and heard from a wine grower in the Pacific Northwest. Her family's been farming the same land for generations. And she said, you know, we are starting to see these shifts in when spring happens and when the harvest occurs. So they're talking about whether the crops that they've grown for generations are going to be tenable in the near future, or whether they're going to have to start thinking about switching their production to different types of crops. So farmers, probably of all Americans, are the most clued in to the seasons and the weather, and they have a wealth of experience and knowledge based on that. As the climate changes, the farmers will likely be some of the first to notice it, and hopefully they will have the resources to be able to respond to it as well so that they can maintain their livelihoods.
Would you call it a no-analog heat wave that just hit France and most of Northern Europe this past summer of 2019?
The heat that hit Europe earlier this year was devastating. The heat index rose, I believe, to about 100 or 105 degrees Fahrenheit, which broke a lot of records in France and in Germany. The fact that we were able to calculate the heat index for that, however, means that it was not a no-analog event. So typically, those no-analog conditions begin to happen with a heat index above 127, so even hotter than what was experienced several times in Europe this summer.
That's interesting, because I did talk to Simone Rousseau, who's an Italian scientist, earlier this year, and he said that temperatures up to 131 degrees Fahrenheit or 55 degrees C could happen in the United States if we keep warming as we're going. So it almost sounds like the Middle East is coming to parts of the United States. I hope we're ready.
When we tried to think about what these no-analog or off-the-charts conditions would feel like to our bodies, we naturally looked to places like the Middle East, where the temperature often far exceeds what we are experiencing in the U.S. Some recent heat waves in India and Iran have given us a sense of what that off-the-charts or no-analog heat feels like. People describe that when you step outside, it feels like you're immediately being wrapped in a hot, wet towel. They'll describe doing things like soaking their sheets in water and sleeping under those. They describe just trying to avoid being outside at all costs. So we do have around the world some precedence for those off-the-charts conditions. It's just that in most parts of the world, we're really not used to them or haven't experienced them at all.
Christina Dahl, tell us about the Killer Heat Interactive Tool, and it's available in both English and Spanish, provided by the Union of Concerned Scientists. So what is it and how do we use it?
You can go to our website, which is ucsusa.org/killerheat. And when you go there, you'll see a whole bunch of different tools. One of my favorites is an interactive mapping tool that allows you to explore all of our data at the county level in the U.S. So you can click on any county and get information about how the frequency of extreme heat is projected to change in that county. You can explore the different scenarios that I've talked about in this program, from a high emission scenario to an optimistic scenario where we really limit our emissions. And you can see how different parts of the country respond to changes in our emissions over time. There's also a great little tool where you can enter your location and just hit go, and it'll spit out the results for you. So you can see if you live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or Indianapolis, Indiana, how extreme heat will evolve for you in the coming years.
I tried that for a bunch of cities where this program is broadcast, and some of them I went, well, that's not too bad, and others I went, oh boy, that doesn't look too good. Now, you know, on this show, scientists like Peter Ward and John Englander warn that sea level rise will be the first and worst impact of climate change. But I'm thinking after at least 100,000 heat deaths in the developed world since the year 2000, Maybe extreme heat will be the most noticeable change in our lives for a lot of people. Your thoughts?
It may be, and it may be that it depends on where you are. We're certainly seeing already with sea level rise that many coastal towns are experiencing more frequent coastal flooding just when the tide is high. It can be a sunny day, but an extra high tide could bring flooding to, you know, parts of downtown Miami Beach or downtown Charleston, South Carolina. So people are seeing that already in their daily lives along the coasts. At the same time, that flooding typically doesn't threaten our health or our lives. And so that's the difference in my mind between sea level rise and extreme heat, that extreme heat is dangerous, and people frequently lose their lives during heat waves. It may be that, you know, living along the coast day to day, seeing the rise in the high tide, you may be experiencing the first effects of climate change, but they may be tenable for a while. Whereas with extreme heat, the more frequently we see these extreme heat events taking lives, causing people to be hospitalized or having to take time off of work and losing their wages due to extreme heat, you know, that may be a more profound impact for many people.
So, Christina, you got your PhD as a paleoclimate expert from MIT and Woods Hole. Why did you move from studying ancient climates to become more of a public voice with the Union of Concerned Scientists?
I got my start in paleoclimate, and it's a fascinating field of research. I was working on trying to understand how the strength and the path of the Indian monsoon had changed over the last 20,000 years or so. But just as I was finishing up my doctoral degree, Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, came out. I don't know if any of your listeners have seen this movie, but it was one of the first to create a compelling and accessible case for how much climate has already changed and where we're headed. And at that moment, I was looking at my data, which looked back at tens of thousands of years, and thinking, is this what we need right now in this moment when we are already feeling the effects of climate change, and we know that they're going to get a lot worse? And the answer, of course, is yes, we always need that information about what our history of our climate has been. But for me personally, I felt the urgency of the climate crisis and really wanted to direct my research energy to the present moment rather than looking back in the past. So it's somewhat of a personal decision to think about what would be most satisfying for me.
Where can people go to find out more about your work, Christina?
You can visit our website, ucsusa.org. You can find my blog posts there. If you go to ucsusa.org/blog, you'll see many posts by my colleagues as well. And as I mentioned earlier, you can check out our extreme heat work at ucsusa.org/killerheat.
From the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C., we have been speaking with senior scientist Dr. Christina Dahl. She led the study, Increased Frequency of and Population Exposure to Extreme Heat Index Days in the United States During the 21st Century, that was published in Environmental Research Communications in July 2019. You can find links to the science we have talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Christy, thank you for looking into this hot topic and explaining it for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.